Coming up today, how not to design a nuclear missile warning system. We step inside a lab that makes lightning and look at the numbers behind the downfall of Carillion. You're listening to episode 352 of the YGK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
And Sian Bradley.
Hi.
Sian, it's your last day.
It is. Very sad.
Very sad indeed. We're sad to see you go, but you'll be back, I'm sure, contributing to Wired.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace. She's not dying.
I know. He said that to me about 10 times already today.
He's only got one joke. Yeah. Only one. Shall we start with a fact from you then, Sian?
Yes. So, turns out that sheep are a bit cleverer than I may have assumed before. So I feel a bit bad on the sheep. So it turns out they can recognise human faces from photographs. So they can be trained to recognise photographs. And like it was scientists at the University of Cambridge. This was back in November, but I didn't see it then. So it's new to me. But they trained him on like Jake Gyllenhaal, Barack Obama and Emma Watson, and they were right like eight out of 10 times. But even if you're not impressed by that, they can actually recognize their handler's photographs without any training. Like if they show them a random person and their handler, they pick the handler like 7 out of 10 times or something. They did like a little double take, so they went to the handler, then went to the other person, then went back to the handler. It's quite cute.
Sheep.
Yeah.
Makes you think. Matt Burgess.
This week I learnt that the person who created the process for mass carbonation of drinks to create fizzy drinks was Johann Jakob Schwepp, which is maybe not a surprise considering the drink's been going for a long time. But when he created the process, it was obviously the first person to have done this, but the drinks were originally sold as medicines, his first drinks. It wasn't like the soda water that they sell today. And he gave them away for free to begin with, but people wanted to pay for them, so he started to think, oh, this could be a commercial idea. And one of the reasons why the drink started to get really popular, particularly in the UK, was because it was backed and endorsed by the grandfather of Charles Darwin.
That is a multi-fact fact.
I've learned a lot
well
this
done,
week.
Which will probably make up for this. Roland, what did you learn this week?
I learnt that
adolescents... He's just looked this up on his phone.
True. Nevertheless, I think it's very interesting. I learnt that adolescence begins at the age of 10.
Okay.
And so this is in a paper that I saw today, or an editorial in The Lancet, suggesting that we should change the definition of adolescence, which is currently thought to be from about kind of 13 to 19. That's when people generally consider it, to... instead be from 10 to 24. And at the bottom end, I mean, obviously this is a slightly arbitrary definition, right? There's no kind of, there's no essential truth about it.
Yeah.
But at the bottom end, there is some kind of biological grounding in all this, because puberty is generally considered to start when the brain, when the hypothalamus in the brain starts releasing a hormone that activates certain glands.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks to improved health and nutrition, the age at which this begins has dropped 4 years in the last 150 years. So instead of starting at 14, it now starts at 10.
Wow. 4 years in that short a span of time.
Yes, I know. And so, you know, for example, the age when girls first get their periods has noticeably dropped in that time.
Crazy.
Well, I apologise, Roland. That is an excellent fact.
So in your face.
Yeah. Sian, you were going to say.
I was just saying, does that mean you have to start calling 10-year-olds teenagers, though?
I think that it's actually as confusing, isn't it? Because we think of teenagers as being synonymous with adolescence. But in fact, it's probably true that adolescence starts much earlier. And in terms of a lot of the kind of behaviours that are associated with it, I mean, in my case, it can go until your 30s.
Ha-ha! I learned this week that in 2016, TfL found £203,538,000 on trains and buses that it operates in London.
Well, just in like loose coins and notes and stuff.
Yeah, I guess some people might lose a 20 every so often. But yeah, mostly in loose change.
Yeah, they have this giant warehouse as well, don't they, where they have all of the lost property that they find on the tubes. Like there's a there's a place where they like just store like one ski or something that they found. Or
who loses a ski?
I don't know. That was an example.
Well, they probably do, I suppose, in time. Yeah, you could
lose. Jeremy White.
Jeremy White, always skiing to work. You can't stop him. Apparently, I think it was something like £2 million over a couple of years they made. They auction off stuff after a while, and I guess they just sell money. Well, sell. They get rid of the money immediately or put it into their coffers anyway, because you can't really go to a lost property office and say, I lost £10. It had a picture of the Queen on it. Our first terrible dad joke. Oh, God. Our first story, Savers Matt Burgess, missiles. It was a bad, bad day in Hawaii on Sunday.
Yeah, so this is probably something that many people have seen, but for a recap for those who haven't seen this over the last week, there was an alert sent out to everybody in Hawaii at 8:05 a.m. last week, and it read, the alert popped up on people's phones, and the message read, ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. And it was all in capital letters, which is pretty alarming if you are just like dozing on a Saturday morning or fast asleep.
I imagine an awful lot of people were fast asleep at 8 o'clock on... Was it a Saturday or a Sunday? Was it the weekend?
It was the weekend.
Yeah. Seems so long ago. The news moves so fast. And it took them 38 minutes to correct that. Obviously, a nuclear weapon wasn't fired at Hawaii. And it all came down to bad user interface.
Yeah, it's the whole problem with this is design. You can obviously sort of blame the person who sent the message out by mistake, but it's not necessarily, it is their fault, but it's not necessarily their fault in the bigger picture of things, because actually the system they were using was badly designed. So there was, the best way to describe it from the pictures that we've seen is like a Word document with a list of hyperlinks in there, all just like written out in straight basic text. The first one says, and slightly paraphrasing, test missile alert. Second one, missile alert. Third one, something else alert.
Yeah, even the wording of them wasn't particularly clear. So if you imagine sort of the very, very early, early website, so
yeah, that's
basically just
good
hyperlinks in a list, randomly ordered, that are easy to click on with no, are you sure you want to send this alert confirmation.
Yeah, which is pretty terrible, really, in terms of design and experience. And basically, if you can see why this message was sent, in accident, because it was always going to happen at some point. But this basically got us thinking, like, how are these messages sent? What are the systems? Does the UK have one? And in short, no, there is no sort of mobile notification system within the UK that exists at the moment. So if a nuke was to come over, there's no way that they could send out an alert system to mobile phones. It should be noted as well that these systems generally are not just for nukes, they're for other things, they're for weather warnings, therefore like earthquake warnings. They can be used for also missing people, missing children.
And so they're mostly used for either if there might be someone on the run from prison and they might want to send out an alert about that, but mostly for natural disasters, potentially missing people. And these are common across the United States. There's a whole infrastructure that's been built with US telecoms companies to allow individual American states to send out mass messages to anyone, even people roaming in that area. So anyone that was in Hawaii, regardless of where in the world they came from, got that alert on their phone if they had the cell signal turned on.
Yeah, and this is done through a process that is called cell broadcasting, which is pretty much, as you've said there, that within a certain area of a mobile phone cell tower, network operators can send out a broadcast push message, basically, to phones. But there's some limitations to these as well, actually, in terms of they can only be 90 characters long, they can't contain any images, they can't contain any links, and they're just pretty inflexible, not very good ways to sort of send out a message. It obviously gets the point across, but if there was a link in this one that was sent out in Hawaii saying check this page for more updates or something like that, obviously it's a pretty tricky situation when a nuke's coming over. You wouldn't be checking too much on a page, but there are many ways that you could sort of enhance a message or give something else out there, especially in other circumstances like weather circumstances or like missing prisoners or things like that, or missing people.
This did give us a morbid window into what might happen were an event like this to occur. And it turned out that an awful lot of people sat on Twitter saying, this can't be real.
Yeah, and it's actually really worrying, like, just on the level that the message was sent out wrongly, because 38 minutes is a long time to correct things. And I've read a lot of things around how people's responded were. They're obviously trying to send messages to loved ones, hiding within baths, within shelters, like running away, trying to just panicking, as you would, because you think the end is nigh. But it's just a really sort of basic balls up.
Yeah.
That shouldn't happen because of a badly designed system and badly designed piece of user interface and technology.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the images that were snapped of this interface, go and check them out. There's been countless news reports written about this. It's absolutely terrifying that this is how a major alert is sent out. A proper piece of government infrastructure is this terrible. But I suppose we should kind of come to expect it, and we'll talk a bit about that with another story later.
Yeah, definitely. And just to sort of go back to sort of the UK angle on this as well, we don't actually have a system like this, but the government is actually looking at creating one. And they're trying to decide, there's been a couple of trials in 2013, 2014, and the conclusion of those trials were that we shouldn't use cell broadcasting, which is the method that's already used. We should use the simple text message, because this can be sort of implemented more easily. It can be a bit more flexible in terms of, as I said, adding links and images and stuff like that. And actually, it's slightly cheaper to produce, and there's some more benefits in terms of like location tracking and how you can send it to more specific locations because it's done through the mobile providers.
Been small-scale trials of this across the country for quite a while, but they're yet to quite settle on how they're going to implement it across the country.
Yeah, the Cabinet Office is trying to decide at the moment. So on the 4th of January it sent out a sort of tender document notice to people saying, we're looking to do this, send us your ideas, we want to work with businesses, blah blah blah. We need to work out some of the more technical aspects to this still, but we want to create a system, because previous alert systems, like there was a contract with the BBC at one point between the Cabinet Office and the BBC that was to utilize their networks when there was a alert needed to be sent out en masse, but that was decommissioned in 2012 because of mobile technologies and things that are a lot more easier to disseminate information than you might not be near a radio or TV. So
yeah,
and it's a changing picture.
It's an eminently practical step to take. We've seen in the UK this week there's been some pretty bad storms, and there was a travel advisory issued, I think, for the north of England and the south of Scotland, because there was a huge amount of snow and wind coming through, and the advice was just don't travel. And if you could easily push that out to every cell phone, mobile phone within the area from the local cell network, cell towers, then that would be a very effective way of getting that message out. Because otherwise, you're relying on people either having listened to the radio, watched television, or be checking social media. So it's a very quick way of issuing simple advice, so long as you do it correctly.
Yeah, it's all about the process and the systems that are involved, and people should take time to get them right. And yeah, really do go, and if you haven't seen the pictures of the Hawaiian system, go and have a look, because it's pretty... It looks like the internet about 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And this leads us seamlessly on to government procurement.
My favourite.
Roland's favourite topic. Roland, there's been some fairly big national news this week in the UK to do with a company that supplies an awful lot of major contracts with the government.
Yeah, and procurement is one of those words that instantly makes anyone's eyes glaze over. But it is absolutely central to so much of everything that goes on in this country, as we've seen with the collapse of Carillion, which was this massive contractor. It did things for the government. It's often called a construction firm, and that was one of the main things it did. It was one of the second biggest construction firm in the country. But it also it provided hospital beds. It did school meals, prisons, all sorts of activities. And its collapse has left its employees, the people who it owed money, the people who it was contracting as third parties to do services, all in real trouble. Including the government. And the mess is going to be cleared up. It's going to take a long time to clear it up.
Yeah. And with the case in Hawaii, it kind of shows the complexity and often the legacy of these government contracts. It's just such a massive thing that stuff can get left untended to for such a long time. And in the case of Carillion, it was the scale of it is vast.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. And I think this was what I dug into this week, because I've known for a little while that there isn't really any information on what the kind of contracts that government makes with people like Carillion.
And you'd think there would be, right? Because you think this is exactly the sort of information that you'd need if you wanted to, say, make a really sensible decision about outsourcing versus taking control of a company.
Yeah.
But in fact, there really isn't. And so using data from a couple of companies, one called OpenOps and one called Open Contracting, they both kind of do stuff around procurement, I tried to look at what kind of contracts Carillion had made with the different parts of government in the last, since 2010. And the first thing that really stood out to me is, man, Carillion has made so many contracts.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, I've got the data here. If you tell me where you're from in the country, I'll tell you how much money that Carillion has spent.
Okay, we'll just wait for someone to call in.
Okay, right, here we come.
We're pre-recording.
On the line, we've got Sian Bradley.
Yeah, no, go on.
Yeah, go on, Sian. Because which county council is your home one?
Ooh, I think Sandwell.
Sandwell, right. This is where we all wait.
The thrilling sound of a man scrolling through an Excel document.
Well, okay, well, nervous. Because so I mean, it's in a way I found this kind of the fact that it was so local and that it brought it back to every single county council.
Yeah.
So in the last 8 years, Sandwell County Council spent £131,000, a little bit more, with Carillion.
At least from the data that we know of.
At least, because this data is extremely partial.
Yeah.
But obviously, and this is the same for every single council county council in the UK, bar one, all the London boroughs, basically every single part of the country.
It's weird, isn't it? Because even though this is such a huge thing, there are businesses that operate in this world that have this many employees and do deals like this, and they will have very, very good record keeping because they'll have to be accountable. So I suppose Carillion did on its end, but on the government end, no one was really paying attention to what was going on.
Yeah, and obviously because, so once you know that Carillion spent £131,000 in Sandwell, the next question is, well, that Sandwell spent £131,000 with Carillion. The next question is, well, what did they spend it on? Mm. And the answer is, we don't know. We actually really don't know. I mean, maybe the records are in PDFs and paper files in government. Maybe they're in comes some kind of part of Carillion's database. But this should be information that is public data, right? And we really don't have a clue. And I think this is kind of the big lesson that I'm drawing from all this, that we need to really rethink how we share information about procurement across the country.
Yeah, so it might not come as a surprise to many people that these big government contracts are very complicated, are quite obscure, opaque. Not obscure, they're opaque.
Both.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And let's, to be honest, deliberately so often.
But what will come as a surprise is nothing's been done about it in such a long time. And the technology is definitely there now to have this kind of transparency and richness of data.
Yes, exactly. And I think if you look at the way that other countries handle procurement, then you can see that there are changes that you can make that don't need to necessarily be political. So they don't need to be about this great debate, an important debate about outsourcing. So in Australia, for instance, they've got an e-tender process, which means that whenever you put out a contract for tender, you've got to put it on one single website. And then when companies apply for that contract, they have to do that through an e-procurement system so they can enter in on the website. And this means that it's possible to keep track of exactly what's going on and, just as importantly, link, for example, the payment side of things and the awarding of the contracts to performance. So, I mean, because you'd think that we do that now, but actually we don't. The two sides of the payment side and the performance side, like literally how well they did, are completely separate.
The government has got some sort of contracts finder or something on its website, but it's not very good necessarily, is it?
Yeah, so contracts finder is the attempt to do this. It was introduced by David Cameron in 2011 and then updated in 2015. But to give you an example, right, so when you search for Carillion on contracts finder, you get 10 results.
Strong.
Ooh. Yeah, strong. I know.
Very good.
I know. I mean, like, even that is something. But until this is used, or you could do it another way. You could require people to put the data in an open, structured format so that it could be pulled into a database. You don't need to create a massive central database, which can be quite unwieldy.
Yeah.
But if you don't know, then how can you act? That's what's kind of crazy about all of this.
And this is a legacy issue. So there's a couple of countries in the world that do this incredibly well, Ukraine and Colombia, where sort of there's a real need. In Ukraine, they had an awful lot of their state taken away by Russia, so they had to start again and regime change. And in Colombia, it's sort of similar. There's kind of constant revolution. It's more stable now, but there was a necessity to start again.
So Ukraine is the most incredible example, because in, was it 2014 or 2015? Oh, I can't. Either one of those years. There was a revolution, and the people on the street ended up taking over the government. Then they got invaded by Russia, so they only have kind of, you know, two thirds of their country. But they basically set about creating the state anew, and they were all very technically minded people. A lot of them had worked in business, and what they set up was a completely different kind of procurement system, which. If you've ever tried to do an ad on Google AdWords, it's a bit like that. So basically, Google AdWords, what they do to get those ads is they make you fill in a bunch of forms, and they test like how fast your site is and how good it looks and how relevant it is. Mm. In this case, you do that, and then they run a reverse auction. It's incredibly clever, cutting edge computer science, to make sure that you get the cheapest, most valuable. Kind of best delivering bid that wins the tender.
Yeah,
and they're saving billions. It's been really efficient, and I think as well they actually have the ability to say whether or not it's working. Because at the moment, in the UK, I mean, this is the same in France, in most kind of legacy or countries with legacy systems.
Yeah,
you simply don't know. You have no metrics, and in a time when you can operate massive systems. With relatively few people, this should just be a standard.
So what's being done?
Oh, nothing.
In the UK, nothing.
Oh, well, I mean, not nothing, but not very much.
Yeah.
And to be fair, it is really, it's really, really hard because government is absolutely massive. You know, I think it's 17% of GDP is spent on procurement. That's a lot of decisions on everything from like paperclips to road tarmacking,
yep.
To you know massive computer services. Mm-hmm. There are some moves in certain parts of government. So like in the digital services, they increasingly now have a kind of a marketplace,
yep.
So that you can say you don't have to kind of get some massive contract with some massive government supplier who's going to give you everything. And then each time you want one tiny little fix, they charge you more. That was basically the old model.
Yeah.
This means that you can at least have contracts that are shorter term, where you can evaluate them. So that's a good thing. But at the moment, it's tiny. And I've got to be honest, I do wonder whether ministers even really understand the need for this or why it's important or what could be done with it.
And it might take more of a generational change for new people to move into... And of public sector employment.
But there are moves in this because this is a global problem.
Yeah,
like every single country in the world has procurement problems, and I think that what open contracting do in terms of laying out a common standard for how contracting data should be presented, that's really it's not exciting. Necessarily,
it really matters.
Yes, and it really matters, yeah. For both kind of corruption and inefficiency, and also moving public services to a point where they just at least function in like what you would consider a normal way.
Reducing waste, improving quality. This is, you know, in a time where economies are struggling for growth, this is a real opportunity to stop throwing money down pits.
Exactly, and that doesn't need to go with either any kind of political agenda.
Yeah.
You know, that you could be a socialist or an ardent neoliberal. It doesn't matter that you should support this because it's just about actually knowing what's going on.
Yeah, I had an anecdote a couple of years ago. I was speaking to someone that was setting up an estate agent, which you might not think is the most inspiring career choice. But they were explaining that in order to access the land registry API, you could only do it during office hours. It was an API with opening hours.
Amazing.
It had to be manned. So these are the kind of technologies that people are working with.
Yes, exactly.
They're so old, they're so creaky, and they're so opaque.
Yeah.
That someone has to sit there and physically keep the API from collapsing.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, there are always, you know, with this data stuff, there are always, it's really complicated, and there are often massive privacy worries. And I worry a lot about that. But this is the kind of data that belongs to us all.
Yeah.
There's no complication about it. This data should be open, and I really hope that someone in government is sitting down and saying this right now.
So if you want to see a little bit of the data cracked open, you can read Roland's story on Carillion if you want to find out a little bit about how the money has been spent across the UK. It kind of gives a snapshot of just how many pies it had its fingers in. And it's remarkable, some of the sums that that you've pulled out. So go and check that out. I do recommend it. Okay, story number three. A few months ago, Sian, you took a trip to a lab that makes lightning, which is a weird thing to do.
I did. So it turns out that hitting electrical equipment with lightning is a really great way to predict failure before it happens. So that's obviously really important because if something on the grid, so like a power line or anything that's connected to the main electrical network, fails, you can have a massive blackout. And that can affect like hospitals, schools, just like all this connected equipment. So you won't really think about, there are actually labs that need to test whether equipment is going to do this. So it's called the High Voltage Laboratory and it's in the University of Manchester. And it's one of the only places in the world that makes lightning.
They definitely make lightning inside.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. It's also really cool to watch as well. But they can test up to millions of volts. So when I did go see it, I obviously had to stay behind glass.
Which is comforting.
Yeah, and they had like a little rod to safety it, and he just always sent in the same person every time, and I did not want to be that guy.
Wow.
To make sure that it earthed it before we went in. I was like, whoa, okay. Yeah. Health and safety was,
pretty extreme. It's a really, really incredible place, and we took along a video crew to make a short documentary, and here's a little taster of what went on.
We've all seen lightning outside, but when you see it from 4 metres, completely different experience. We would test sometimes for millions of volts of lightning, and you would see a good 4 meter lightning bolt. That's very impressive. There's not a lot of places within the world that can actually do this kind of thing, and I think this is going to be quite a revelation in terms of where we're coming from.
So we're posting that full documentary. It's only about 3 minutes long. It's super, super beautiful. You can watch it on our YouTube channel. We'll be posting it on Saturday. So if you're listening to this immediately after we publish on Friday, just wait a few hours. It will be appearing on YouTube on Saturday. So Sian, tell us a little bit more about what goes on there.
Yeah, so in the clip we just heard, that was Doddy. That was great. It was Dr. Vidhi Pishpati with his team. And they do loads of great things. So it is a teaching place as well, so you have lots of students there just sort of learning about electrical engineering and things. But the main thing they do is in this one big room with all this cool 80s equipment, and they mimic rain, wind, like long-term aging. It's basically to see how this equipment that's either been on the network for a while or is going to go on the network, how it's going to perform in the real world. And they'll pass just like thousands of volts through it and just see when it sort of gives in.
And as he says on the little clip that we heard there, this is proper lightning. This isn't just little sparks of electricity. This is massive bolts of incredible amounts of energy.
Oh yeah, it was literally as if you were seeing a lightning bolt closer than like you ever would.
Yeah.
It's like watching a film or something.
So does it have a smell? Can you taste it?
Well, behind the glass, no.
Yeah.
You can sort of taste burning. Taste? Smell? Senses are all the same anyway. But yeah, you can see it hit. If they put water on it, it'll hit the certain bits of water. If they put like a pin, it'll hit the same spot every time. So it's just crazy, all these things that they just take for granted every day. They go to work and they can just see this incredible lightning bolt, and it's part of their job.
And it's a completely controlled environment. This is the important thing. So it allows them to test things over and over and over again and in loads of different conditions. And as we start to electrify more and more things, electric cars, microgrids around cities, distributed power networks, this is going to become a really, really important kind of experiment.
Yeah, because I think when people think about the future of energy and power, they think about fossil fuels and sustainability and things like that, but when you think about electric cars, you don't think about the stress it's putting on the grid, and I think people really consider that it is a limited supply. They just think that you just have electricity. So we just raised really interesting points about how we're deciding the network for the next 50, 60 years right now, and if we're going to rely on it more, then we really need the equipment that can withstand it. And it doesn't have to be the massive power lines either. It can go straight down to the cables in your homes, like your phone lines or just whatever connects your home, because they also test... It looks like trees, so it's when like a cable splits,
yeah,
they'll fast forward the process of that happening, and they have like this really cool little tree model. It looks like a tree. It's just the cable splitting all the time, but they use science to speed it up. It's just really interesting, and they all just get to do that every day.
And as we always wonder, how do these people get the jobs that they get? How do you become head of the Lightning Lab?
Indeed. Become an electrical engineer in Manchester.
There you go. Yeah. That's how, if you're listening, kids. So what's the full video when it's posted up? As I say, it's only about 3 minutes long, and it's pretty amazing. Okay, final thing, a quiz.
No.
Yes. Oh. Yes. Okay, this week YouTube clamped down on the somewhat strange internet sensation of people recording themselves eating Tide Pods.
Yes.
Suffice to say, this isn't a particularly good idea. They're full of chemicals. They're not good for you. They're meant to wash, what, dishes? Clothes?
Clothes,
yeah. Not your insides. I want to know, how much do you know about the world of memes and viral content trends? Yes.
Burgess is happy.
Yes, Matt Burgess is going to win. Okay, question 1 of 5. Where, and we're going to go, so Matt, you're going to answer this one first, and then we'll rotate through as we go, for fairness.
Okay.
Where does the word meme come from?
Are you, what do you mean in terms of like a geographic location?
Well, you can try that, but no. What's the origin?
I don't know this. I'm just going to say Japan.
Thanks. Okay.
The first time I heard it was a coining by Richard Dawkins in relation to the notion that that ideas spread kind of through a process of evolution.
Okay, Sean.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to top that, am I?
I think he's right as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, what can I even
say? Let's give it to Roland. Yeah, he's right. So Richard Dawkins coined the word meme in his book, The Selfish Gene, which I think was published in the 1980s?
Yeah, it's been around a while.
It's been around a while.
A truly terrible book.
Well, wow. Whoa.
Damn.
Dawkins, if you're listening, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's shortened from ancient Greek mimema, which means to imitate. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Nice. Question 2. What words come next in this famous Flash cartoon music video published in September 2003? Badger, 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 badger.
I have no idea.
Oh, Roland. Sean?
2003.
Burgess just gave a tiny little cheer to himself there.
He's remembered.
He's jumping up and down with excitement. I was in 2003. I was like in year 3.
All right, all right.
I was too young to know what the internet was.
Yeah. Now, okay, so I say badger, 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 badger.
I think I say mushroom duck. Is that correct?
You're so close that I'm going to give it to you. Because if you hadn't have said the word duck, it's mushroom, mushroom.
Oh.
There are no ducks in this song. I also would have accepted or panic a snake.
Yeah. Good to know, right?
Yeah, it was a great...
What was that?
Go and look it up.
Okay.
Question 3. So that's 1 point to Burgess, 1 point to Roland, no points to Sian.
No. Got to be a bit more recent.
Yeah. Okay, you've got a chance. Question 3. Nyan Cat was a cat that... flew through space with a rainbow trail behind it.
Yes.
But what is its body made of?
Pop-Tart.
Burgess?
Sponge.
Roland?
Popcorn.
Yeah, it's a Pop-Tart.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's 1-1. Very good.
I know my cats.
Yeah.
Can I say?
Especially the Nyanning cats. What is the cinnamon challenge?
Oh.
That is when people try to eat a certain amount of cinnamon in a certain amount of time without... sneezing, coughing, something like that.
Okay.
Mm. Isn't that right?
It's when
pretty
they
close.
Snort
There's
it.
One other element.
Isn't it when they snort it?
Oh, it's not something to do with like lighting it or something, or that you sort of sprinkle it and it makes kind of flames go a certain colour.
No.
No.
Sorry.
I thought they snorted it.
Okay, cool. Matt Burgess gets that one, but only because he went first. The bit that you missed was you can't drink anything.
Ah.
Which is what makes it difficult.
So yeah. Like the cracker challenge.
Yeah. But apart from this one might do you serious bodily harm. So it's dangerous because it dries out your mouth, it dries out your throat, which can make you cough, which can make lungs collapse, it can make you gag, it can make you vomit. It's just really, really dangerous. It's not a particularly good idea. So it sounds like, oh, I could eat a spoon of cinnamon. Don't try it. Really bad idea. Question five. In what year was the first cat video uploaded to YouTube?
Wow, good question. So, hang on, how long has YouTube been going?
Well, this is a question you'll need to work out, isn't
it? Yeah. I think that YouTube's been going, actually, not as long as you think. I think it's only been 10 years. So I'm going to say 2007.
Sean?
Well, after 2003, there was...
Oh, yeah, good point. Wow. So incredible, incredibly slow reasoning there. I'm ashamed.
Okay, so the first cat video on YouTube, I'm just going to say like 2001 or something.
Okay.
I'm going to go either go before that or a couple of years after.
Great.
Well,
go
there's
on,
two
man.
Options.
It's
go one way.
2002.
Hang on. So, Roland, you said 2008.
Yeah, something.
Sean,
something
you said
like
2001. One.
I said 2002.
Okay, yeah, you win, but only by being, yeah.
Default.
Being you. So, Matt Burgess wins. Well done. Hooray. 2005.
Ugh.
It was uploaded by YouTube co-founder Steve Chen. He posted a video of his cat called Pajamas Playing with a Rope.
Oh, I want to watch that.
It's a classic. Quick search for cats on YouTube now returns 88.8 million results.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, because there'll be plenty of videos of cats that aren't
under cat.
Called cats.
Mm. Well, there we go.
Cat fails are the best, though.
Cool.
Just so everyone knows, in case you're looking for some inspiration.
And that will be the last thing that Sean Bradley ever says on the YGK podcast. RIP in peace. We will see you again next week. Have a lovely week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.